This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time. Stephanie Faye Frank offers neuroscience education that leads organization-wide mindset shifts and innovation through her online videos, podcasts, and her consulting services. She uses her award-winning research in neuroscience and fieldwork as a counselor and educator and consultant to maximize our brain's creative power. She implements interactive strategies to bring these concepts to life within the classroom. For more information, visit mindsetneuroscience.com. In part two of my interview with Stephanie Faye Frank, we explore the dark side of growth mindset and why it's important to go beyond the superficial teaching of adaptability. We discuss some of the physiological clues that suggest whether a student is experiencing fight, flight, or freeze, and how to become more aware of our own body language in order to create a safe environment for our students. I think there's another element to this that you've explored within your podcast, where you talk about that there are certain elements that actually hold us back from developing a sense of growth mindset as well. And I'd love to touch on a few of those, including sort of the dark side of the extreme growth mindset advocates, because I found that really, really interesting within the context of education, if you wouldn't mind talking about that.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I tend to see this happen with a lot of different, just buzzwords that just float around, and then people end up taking them to this extreme, to this very either or kind of thinking. So growth mindset's, no exception. So something that I've seen in my work is that there's what I would call the hyper belief, or the, I actually call it top-down extremism. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is when we're creating top-down change, especially from more of a neuroscience perspective, what we're saying is that kind of this idea of mind over matter, our beliefs and the different programming that we have, that we can create change, and we can actually literally, which is true, we can literally rewire our brain. We can change different architecture in our brain based on the thoughts that we choose to think and different belief systems, and becoming more conscious of different things that are going on. So that's the top-down approach, where we're almost using something you could call like mental force or something metacognitive to make changes in our body, in our brain. The environment can create change in our brain, or that person around us can affect us in a way that creates change. So that's the bottom-up version of that. And so what I'm seeing in growth mindset is going to this top-down extremism, where people are saying it's all about mind over matter. It's always about belief. That's the only thing that matters. The only thing that matters is you have to just believe in yourself, and that will change everything. And you will do amazing at anything you set your mind to, as long as you believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. And while I do think there's some truth to that, I think that our beliefs are so incredibly powerful, and I do think we have to give a lot more acknowledgement to how powerful our mind is. It is a really dangerous path to go down, in a sense, because what it can also do is, on the one hand, it can create a sense of apathy in society, because it really lets people off the hook from ever trying to address conditions, the right. conditions of poverty or stress or trauma or all those other things that are happening in people's lives, because they basically then you get to say, oh, so those people that are living in extreme adversity, they just have to believe in themselves more. Right. That's the problem.
Yeah, and it minimizes it.
It creates almost a judgment.
Yes.
It minimizes it. It creates a bit of a judgment, because it's basically saying, oh, see, if it were me in that position, see, I believe in myself, so that I probably would do better than that right. person is doing. So it really lets society off the hook. And what's so dangerous about that is what we really, really know from lots and lots and lots of research, and in particular Harvard Center for the Developing Child has a lot on this, is that our earliest environments matter so much. Mm-hmm. And what we are the most nurture dependent species that has ever existed on the history of the planet. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that our brain and the very human parts of our brain, especially something like the prefrontal cortex, the areas of our brain that allow us to have these executive functioning skills, which help us just really have a control center where we can think about the future, weigh pros and cons, have impulse control, control our impulses, communicate more clearly, moral reasoning, all of that stuff is really housed in that frontal area, in the prefrontal cortex. And that prefrontal cortex is almost completely experience dependent. It is not genetic. We are not born with executive functioning skills. Mm. We are only born with the potential to develop them. And if we don't get what we need from our earliest environments, and in particular, the relationships from the adults in our earliest environments, it becomes very, very difficult to develop those, the networks that are involved in that prefrontal cortex and executive functioning. And so if you start out, even in the womb, if there are stress hormones that are going through your mother and you are sucking those up into the amniotic fluid, those stress hormones alone affect your brain architecture. Wow. They can lower cognitive capacity. They can make people more afraid, just more fearful and anxious. Mm. And then, so that's just the womb alone. So when you have a stressed out mom, just that's already an environment, and that's 9 months of it. Mm-hmm. So already there, the playing field might not be equal.
Right.
And, you know, because of how the human brain, what's beautiful about it is that there is so much potential for it to create so many unique aspects and faculties because it isn't genetic. And that's the beauty of the human brain, that we're not born with just the choice of like reflexes and autopilot routines. Right. We're so incredibly creative. But the tricky part of that is that it does mean that what happens to us earliest, or especially early on, but at any point in our life, but really what happens early on really builds our brain. It matters so much. Mm-hmm. And so what life throws at us is going to be more, in some ways more important, especially for those aspects of human intelligence and brain development, than what genes offered. Because genes can only cover a certain amount of information. They don't cover the prefrontal cortex. There's just not enough information right. in the genes for that. So when we go down the path of saying it's always about belief, just belief in yourself. So the one extreme from that is that it doesn't acknowledge that actually that's not true. The existing neural architecture of the students that are coming into your classroom will 100% of the time be different, always, because their experiences are different and our brains are so experience dependent. And it won't be a level playing field, so we can't treat it as though it is, and we can't expect one child who is born into an extremely stressful environment with maybe very little parental supervision or stressed out parents who weren't really there, they're not going to have the executive functioning skills the way another student who was born in a very safe, nurturing, enriching environment is going to have. So it will not be about belief at that moment. It's about, you know, trying to basically just offer as much as we can to help, especially people who don't have that much enrichment or nurturing in their earliest years, to give that to them at whenever we can.
So important. And I think it brings me to this point of, okay, so considering that I'm looking at this as an educator. So considering that we have this diversity of students and we have children who have experienced adverse childhood trauma, for example, and experiences, mm-hmm. how can we enable them to develop a growth mindset, to have this experience of, I think you've called it serve and return, where they mm-hmm. build an experience that reflects that growth mindset, that enables them to be safe within their environment, and that lets them, through your guidance, through your ability to co-regulate with them, to guide them into that more, just mm-hmm. that safer place within mm-hmm. their own minds?
Yeah, I think it's something so important to be thinking about. And also just to kind of lead into that also, the other danger of the growth mindset related to that is that people are, you know, saying like, just believe in yourself, or just, you know, love your mistakes and love all that. But the other danger of getting way too caught up in that is it takes the onus, or the, you know, the idea of growth mindset away from the teacher. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it be, oh, I'll just keep teaching the same way, And they just have to believe in themselves more, or they just have to love their mistakes more. But the truth is, if they're not learning, something is going on in the classroom. And I think it can be way more powerful to be thinking about what can we do for teachers to help them have a growth mindset in those moments? How do we help teachers? And this goes up to the highest place of the ripple effect. So that's going to go to the principals, that's going to go to, you know, the district superintendents, it's going to go up and up and up. Mm-hmm. But to be thinking about how do we allow teachers to experiment more and be more in the moment, dynamic and organic with each student, so that they can play with, oh, they're not learning this way, let me figure out how to make some adjustments to help them get to that place. So, and then in line with that, that's where, you know, we could really help teachers be thinking about this idea of, you know, the building up of the brain, the serve and return dynamics, and in particular, the physiological sense of safety that they can actually create in a classroom. Mm-hmm. And it's something that not a lot of teachers, I think, necessarily think about, but there are a whole bunch of things that can happen in those moment-to-moment interactions and in the conditions in the classroom that are either going to heighten the chance that a student is going to have what they need online in terms of their brain circuitry or diminish it completely. And so part of that is, like, you know, I think we were going to touch on this, but there's this idea of, well, I'll call it psychological safety, but there's a physiological component to it. And you mentioned the word co-regulation. So that's exactly it, is that as humans, it is essential for us to know how to co-regulate. And what that means is our body is always trying to get into a place of homeostasis, which is not a static state. It's always changing. Our body's always trying to make adjustments to whatever's happening. And humans do it through social connectedness, through this idea of co-regulation. So when we, you know, when we're born, we cannot escape the fact that, just even the fact that we're mammals also, we have to, the only way we can survive is if we are have co-regulation in our life, where we have another human who can regulate with us. And we do that in a multiple number of ways. But one particular way we help each other regulate and, you know, get to those balanced kind of states of homeostasis is through something called the social engagement system. And this comes from Stephen Porges, who founded this thing called the polyvagal theory. Mm-hmm. But it's this idea that we actually are gifted with this incredible structure of particularly this nerve called the vagus nerve. And it controls so many different parts of our body. It controls many, many, many of our internal organs. It is actually part of the heart's pacemaker. It puts a brake on the heart so we can slow our heart rate. But it also has extensions into our brainstem and also our facial, like different muscles in our face to express different, you know, facial expressions. And a huge part of what this nerve is doing is it is allowing us to project to others our emotional state and also detect from others what their emotional state is. Mm-hmm. And that projection and detection of what our emotional state is what allows us to be in relationship with other people and to regulate. And so part of what that nerve does and all these, you know, features of it is, for example, allows us to express to someone when we're in distress, when we're stressed out, or when we feel really safe and calm. And part of how it will do that is actually through especially the muscles around the eyes. Mm-hmm. So there's a softening and a crinkling in the eyes when we feel very safe. And a kind of an alertness or a very flat expression when we aren't feeling good, when we're in pain or when we're stressed out. And there's also not quite related to the same nerve, but there is a tension that happens in our jaw when we're stressed out. And there's more the below the nose, all of those muscles are more for indicating aggression and stress. We also change the way our vocal folds, the way they work, is they try to project our emotional state. And so we have this thing called prosody, P-R-O-S-O-D-Y, which is our ability to use our voice to indicate our emotional state. And when we're stressed out, we don't have as much prosody. It goes very flat and kind of robotic sounding. So a mother, for example, who is very, very stressed out or depressed is going to lack prosody in her voice. She's going to have flat facial expression. And what that actually does is it triggers the stress response in another person.
Right.
So when we are not in a good emotional state, this is literally the contagious nature of emotions. When we're not in a good emotional state, it will literally send those micro signals, these micro movements of the face and the vocal folds, which changes the sound waves and all that, sends those signals to the other person. And that person will then have a stress response because that basically is saying it's not safe between us at the moment. I'm not feeling right.
I think a lot of people will have a big aha with this. And the reason I laughed there is because I go, yep, that feels pretty familiar, you know, that flat tone as a mom. And so it's... And even as an educator, right? I mean, it can be very easy to get stressed out. And so being mindful not only of the way that our children and students are presenting with that, you know, within their facial features and their gestures, but also within the way that your own expression can impact theirs. And I think that's a really, really important point, is that we have a really big impact on the way that they feel within the classroom and even on one another.
Yes, very much. And, you know, the thing is, we can't avoid being stressed. You know, it's going to be a part of our lives. And so it's not, we're not saying that you always have to be this incredibly upbeat, energetic, very facially expressive person. It's not necessarily about that. That's not realistic.
Yeah.
But it is about, number one, exactly what you're saying, just being a little bit more aware of that and knowing that we do need to have some times where we do have that very present engagement where we're really, truly present with that person. And that will be that's what allows some of those signals to come back on. And so another issue is not just stress, and, you know, those kinds of emotional states, but, distraction. And so it's something called the violation of neural expectations, is when because we are so incredibly reliant on these little, you know, I would call bio signals between each other. If you know, let's say we're with a child, let's just use a child and caregiver example.
Sure.
If that caregiver is with a child, there is a neural expectation for there to be fairly constant feedback, or at the very least, you know, from moment to moment, and there can be pauses in it. But if the caregiver, for example, is on her phone and distracted by a screen, she's violating those social expectations. She's violating the social engagement system. We are not built for that. We're not built to be in the presence of somebody and then for them to be turning away from us. It actually is the turning away is a very small, but it's a bio signal to another that you are not engaged with them, and so therefore it's not safe. And it's interesting because it's been replicated a lot of times. It's kind of a sad research experiment. Like, you feel so bad for the baby when they're doing this, and it's very short, so they try not to traumatize anybody, but it's called the still face experiment. You see them actually go through this exact cascade of what this polyvagal theory kind of predicts, which is that we always start, every human, we are built for the social engagement. That's our most evolved system. So we always start with our most evolved system because that's where we're most at our most evolved. And so we always will attempt to make facial gestures and use this kind of voice and vocalization, and we'll do that to connect with each other. But if that doesn't get met, if that's violated because the other person has flat expression or they look away or they're just not there, we then actually go into more of a sympathetic system arousal, which is blood flow to our skeletal muscles. And that gets us ready for limb movement, which is the fight or flight response. So that's when it gets a little bit more anxious and just aroused, you know, usually hyper aroused. And then if that doesn't get met, we actually then the next system comes online. It's a different part of the same nerve, but it's a slowing down, it's a shutting down, and it's a almost literal folding over of the body. The heart rate goes extremely low. Sometimes it can go dangerously low. And it's a closing off of almost everything. The blood flow gets very restricted. The body will almost even be colder. And you could almost see that this becomes the shame posture, because it's a literal folding over of the body in resignation. Wow. And so shame is one of the hardest places for us to be in. It's the least kind of evolved state. Mm-hmm. And so we see it in mammals also. So in this still face experiment, we see the actual cascade in real time. And they've also done this with puppies. It's really sad. But
oh, man.
So they start with the mom and the baby, and the baby's facing her, and you know, they first have just their normal play, and you, when you watch the normal play, it's so obvious how much of this serve and return. The baby serves and looks to see what's returned. Mm-hmm. It's this kind of biofeedback, you know, experimentation of, oh, I made this facial gesture, I got this back, and that's how they build their brain. So they're doing it, that's how they're naturally wired. But then they instruct the mom to have a completely still face for the next, I think, 60 seconds. She is not allowed to do anything in response to the baby. Mm-hmm. So, the baby starts with the most evolved system. It keeps going with the vocalization, the facial gestures, and yeah, la, la, you know, mm-hmm. it's making noises, social engagement system. She's not responding. Almost like real, quite quickly, the baby goes into really agitated, very irritated, anxious, very uncomfortable. It's so uncomfortable to watch because he's squirming. He's trying to get out of the chair. He's getting kind of, it looks like almost a little bit angry, very, very aroused and irritated, agitated. She still doesn't respond. And then he goes into shutdown. He looks away. He can't look at her anymore. He's slumped over. Mm-hmm. He gives up. Mm-hmm. And then she immediately comes in, and then it's so sweet because it's like, even though she just did that, I guess it doesn't matter, because as soon as she comes in, it goes right back to smiles and giggles. So,
yes.
It makes you feel better in the end. But yeah, but that is just an example of, we are wired in certain ways, and we're wired for that presence with each other, mm-hmm. and that true social engagement. And so what teachers, you know, I think it's really important for them to keep that in mind when they're in the classroom, that they are projecting out these bio signals. And so that is where it sounds so cheesy, but that self-care is so incredibly yes. important for teachers. And that's why schools need to acknowledge that so much more also for teachers, that they need to have some of that self-nurturing to take place for themselves, so that as they enter the classroom, they can be projecting those signals, those micro signals that will kind of help feed the vibe in the classroom in a certain way.
Yeah. Oh, and it's, again, I'm just making so many connections to the way that we interact with our students, that if we're, you know, even the way that we validate student input within a class discussion, that sort of thing, if you don't have sort of a validating approach to your response, that could even yes. feed into this whole, this feedback loop, right? This idea
yes.
that, oh, clearly what I'm saying isn't the right answer, and therefore it might trigger that
yes.
shutdown, which we see time yes. and again with students. We see that all the time. And so perhaps yeah. we can help them to retrain some of that, if mm-hmm. because I think also within the experiment, it's got an element of optimism to it. The fact mm-hmm. that we are so adaptable, the fact that
yep.
in spite of the fact that that mom may have shut down for a bit, the baby was still mm-hmm. open to the interaction. And so as mm-hmm. educators, taking that and going, but we have the power to change that,
yes.
reframe it,
yes.
and be very, very aware of the way that we interact, both verbally, but also in the physical and in mm-hmm. the nonverbal communication. So I just think, oh, mm-hmm. that's incredible examples.
Yeah. Yeah. Before, like, we can make a comeback.
Yeah.
No matter, you know? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
and exactly. And I think that, I mean, although, like you said, you don't want to sort of skate on the surface of it's only your beliefs that matter, there is that sort of adaptability that all human beings have that enable
yes.
us as educators to bring out their best, you know, their best expression of themselves and to really tap into their potential. We talked about top-down extremism, which is the belief that our success lies in our ability to control our own thoughts, rewrite our stories. While this can be a powerful model, it's important to remember that someone's adverse and traumatic experiences can make it extremely challenging to reframe thinking. Therefore, thinking alone is not always enough to overcome adversity. We need to be advocates for creating better circumstances at home and within the classroom so that our students can be healthy and happy learners. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.